Okay, welcome everyone to the Q&A session for April 2nd. As you see, Chris is not with us tonight, hence the technical glitches all over the place to get started. And Chris is doing his Fun with Fonts presentation in Saratoga, Florida tonight. I warned him that was a bad idea. He probably has to talk for 25% more of the time, but he insisted he was going to do it, so there we go. I think Bob has muted everyone's microphone. You should have the ability to unmute and ask a question. If you do that, then please remute afterwards in order to keep background noise to a minimum. The alternative is to enter your questions and comments in the chat window, and Bob will be monitoring that throughout the evening. And as usual, after the meeting, the presentation file, the audio recording, and the contents of the chat window will be posted on the website for you to review. And anyway, for now, let's get started with a follow-up from last week. There we go. So as you recall, we had a kind of a practice session with Gypsy Meat, and a number of people got together after the main Q&A session. I didn't actually count how many were there, but it was probably, I don't know, 16 to 20 or so. And I had things to do, so I had to leave them to it. And there were some hardliners there. They were in it for the long run. I wasn't sure, because I started the meeting, whether when I left that would kill the meeting for everybody else. So I sent Jeff a note, and I asked, you know, did it kill it, or could you carry on? And he said, well, they kept going until 10:15. It was a real social meeting. It looks like they were talking about physics most of the time. And the interesting thing was, though, that everybody had moderator control, so they could change each other's names, display names, and throw people out of the session and all kinds of wonderful things. And that was one of the things that Chris was concerned about Jitsi, that it seemed to give everybody control over everything, and that's not necessarily a good thing. But Jeff noted that there's probably a way to set it up so that you can either be a moderator or a participant, and then you can send out a different link to, you start the meeting as a moderator and then choose a link that doesn't let people do everything and send that to them as participants. And of course, what I'd done, I'd just gone to the main website and done the obvious thing, hit the big start meeting blue button here, which clearly gives everybody control over everything. But if you look carefully down the bottom there, it says, or book a meeting URL where you're the only moderator. So if you click on that one, then you actually get this screen, and you've got two different choices there. And this is the one for guests, and this is the one for moderators, and you can choose which one you wish to use. So Jitsi is a possibility if you want to run video conferencing with friends and family. And it's completely free, relatively easy to use. It's a bit of a learning curve, I guess. Probably no worse than Zoom tonight for me. And so it's an option, Jitsi Meet. Okay, next up, a follow-up on Signal. There was some discussion about this messaging app, and one of the members sent this note in as a follow-up that they'd seen this as a free option, which is a system that's based on security, essentially. It's cross-platform, multi-platform, works with Windows and Linux and Android and all kinds of other things, Mac and Apple stuff as well. It's secure because it has end-to-end encryption, and they say it gives you crystal clear voice and video calls, and you can do things like sharing text files and messages, photos, etc., etc. You can use your phone's data or Wi-Fi connection, so that means you avoid SMS text message fees, or the multi-messaging system fees if you want to send media files, and also long distance charges if you're making a connection between two individuals. You're not using the phone line, you're actually using the internet. So if you're interested in Signal, then you can go to signal.org and try it out. Question came in about eSIMs, and has anybody used an eSIM? I haven't, so I actually posted this thing on the user forum. Had anybody used an eSIM, and in particular, had anybody used one in the UK or France? And a number of people commented. Kind of a general comment came in that eSIMs, they're generally easy to set up, although they might be difficult the first time. They're available for all phones. All current phones can handle them, either Android or iPhones. You generally download them from a vendor directly to the phone, and then you'll have instructions on how to actually activate it. And they're available for voice calls, voice and data calls, or you can get them for data only. And this individual uses a data only version because all he wanted to do was go onto the internet and do things like use Google Maps or make messaging, video, phone calls using WhatsApp, for example. So he only needed data. He didn't need the actual voice and data function. Some other people kicked in. Karen said that she's used Aerolo in the USA, although they have plans all over the world. She found it easy to use and good value. Tom noted that if you have a Visa card, you can get a free eSIM for a certain amount of data, I guess, and it expires after 15 days. But you can use Fongo for calls to Canada, and again, WhatsApp, if you want to connect with other WhatsApp users. And Ed had used Aerolo again, which had been recommended by CAA to him, and he'd used that in Europe. And then Stu's pointed out that there's a whole raft of these things, and he's been looking at them. Some of them call themselves borderless carriers, although what it is really is international roaming sort of thing. And he's got this list of companies here, so make a note of that, or you can download this from the website later on tonight. If you're interested in any of these companies, then the various URLs are there to get to them. Okay, another question that came in was concerning AI products, and this individual's brother asked about AI relating to an issue with her mother. They got a really extensive reply, but it wasn't terribly helpful. She asked him what AI he was using, and said that a lot of people in OPCUG seem to like Perplexity. And he says he uses Perplexity mostly for travel because it's really good at that. But he tends to use either ChatGPT or Gemini for other things. So the question was, what are people's thoughts on ChatGPT and or Gemini? And so because it's an AI product, we're going to ask our AI guru to kick in. And our AI guru, of course, is Bob Harris. And Bob, if you're unmuted, you should have slide control and you can tell us all about it.
Very good. Well, the guru is not here tonight, so I'll try to step in and do what I can know. It's good to see people interested in using AI. I don't know if I can answer the question, but I'll certainly give it a shot in my opinion about these things. So we can talk about ChatGPT a little bit and maybe Gemini. And since you mentioned Perplexity, let me get the slide control right. Let's include Perplexity AI in here also. So we'll take a look at these. And a quick look, we have slide control is very sensitive. Here we go. The first one is ChatGPT. I call it the conversational pro. It's like the friend who always has the answer. This has been around since November 2022. ChatGPT can actually generate content and it can summarize things. People don't understand this as much, but it understands natural language, very important at that. It excels at creative writing tasks and it'll generate ideas. ChatGPT can even generate graphics, but you only get two or three of those per day with a free account. It does coding and research. I have no idea what coding is, so I won't comment on that. But you can upload PDF files to the ChatGPT. And it gets over a billion queries per day. And according to the news in the last few days, that number might be outdated. In my opinion, the biggest problem with ChatGPT, or weakness, not a problem, is hallucinations. Now, that could be already outdated. Everything is changing so quickly. But in my experience, it's absolutely perfect for writing ideas and writing text and other ideas. And I feel with those things, I can't be fooled. If I get something that doesn't contain the inflection I'm looking for, I simply tell it in my own personal words. And so for writing tasks, it's phenomenal. But because of my past experience with hallucinations, I avoid using it for hard facts. I should note that all AIs can make mistakes. And anyway, so I avoid ChatGPT for hard facts. In the presentation tonight, you've seen a few graphics. And I can say that I did all these graphics first time round by using ChatGPT to make the prompts, and I had the graphics made in other programs, but I used ChatGPT for the prompt only and then went somewhere else for the actual content. Anyway, so, and next slide here. Here we go. Next is Gemini.
Sorry, Gemini. Bob. Yeah. This whole thing was my question. Could I ask you what you mean by hallucinations?
Oh, sorry. Excellent question. Hallucination is it gives you the wrong answer. It's seeing things. I should have made myself more clear. And that's a common word. I should have been more plain. Thank you for the question. That's important. You can get blatantly, I've asked it for, even in this thing tonight, I've asked all of them for different tables on what the multimodal features are, and they've all made mistakes. I mean, really, I know what some of them, now, I'll do this in a couple of slides. The problem is that things are changing so fast, so that's part of it too. But I don't use ChatGPT when you want something really concrete. If I want to send you a note by email, make it look nice, I'll throw it in ChatGPT first and say, tune this up, throw a mess in there. It comes out looking like a rose. And then I tweak it from there. But it's a great writing skills. So this is a quick summary here, but thank you for the question. For Gemini, it's been around since December 2023. It came to Canada in February 2024. Before it was Gemini, it was called Bard. Gemini is multimodal, meaning it'll handle text, images, and audio. It too can generate graphics, and it works well to send your data to coordinate well with Google Sheets and Gmail. I have no idea what coding is and that research. I haven't tried the new deep research part of Google Gemini. And when I refer to AI, I'm using the free versions on all these so far. I haven't paid for anything yet. That's coming soon, I'm sure. It won't be free forever. But haven't used deep research yet at all. And next slide here. Multimodal features. If you're in Gemini and you want to use the multimodal features, when you put something in the prompt box, immediately the little icons at the bottom will appear. And the little icons will allow you to do export your content into Google Docs or Gmail. Simply copy it. You can also drag and drop your PDF files into the prompt box. And more recently, you can now upload, drag and drop, or from your hard drive, copy JPEG and PNG files. I can tell you that I think it was the PNG file. It was not there in the past 10 days or 2 weeks ago. It wouldn't do it in the past, but it's evolving quickly. but upload your features. Gemini receives a little, almost 10 million visits per day. The advanced button is very precise here, so I'm slow at that. I'd say its main weakness is, or was now, aggressive content filtering. It's very sensitive to what it considers to be sensitive. But this is changing. I can tell you, again, till recently in the past 2 weeks, if I fed it an AI-generated photograph for comments or editing or evaluation, it wouldn't accept anything even possibly remaining to a person, whatever. But now it'll take those things, and it'll summarize almost any image. So that, too, is very quickly changing. And
so Bob's asking, which one is better for helping to do a resume?
I would start off with that one. A resume, you want hard facts and no... I would go Perplexity with that first off. It wouldn't hurt to throw both in, though. I would trust ChatGPT for the inflection you want. That one's a tough. I couldn't give you a clear answer on that. That's coming up the same thing, too. You wouldn't want to have errors on your resume. And I wouldn't trust chat. I'm gun-shy on the weaknesses for ChatGPT for the hallucinations.
One answer, Bob, might be try everything and take the best bits from them all.
That's coming up for sure, yes. That's coming up. Yep. So, anyway, my favorite tool with Gemini, I said it once before, haven't heard it at all. If you see these clickbait videos, nothing clickbait, Kevin Stratford has amazing video content. You see this video here. It says, I have to know these five hidden features in Windows. But I haven't got 8 minutes to watch every video out there. But I really want to know the features. So nothing derogatory to Kevin Stratford. He makes great content. So this is where Gemini comes in again. If you don't already be aware of this, you simply right mouse click on the video content or the address bar. You copy that, pop that into the prompt for Google Gemini, paste it into there, and say, please summarize this video. And when I say URL, that's the Uniform Resource Locator. And don't watch the video, Thomas. I don't want the content is distracting here. But anyway, it's just an example of that. So you pop that into the video and into your prompt. And right away, I went too far here, sorry. Hit twice. Sorry. You'll pop that into your prompt, and in seconds, you'll get a complete summary of your video, complete with timestamps, the whole works. There's a detailed summary. Now, you have to wait for Gemini to watch the video. But when it watches an 8-minute video, it'll take 3 seconds to watch an 8-minute video. You don't have to wait long. You do not have to watch the entire video. The timestamps tell you the content. I won't get involved in the content here, but it does an amazing job. So I'd like you all to use this tool, but don't use please summarize this video. I want you to get the information you want with your own natural language. And to prove this point, I put something stupid in there. I used the same video for Windows 11 updates, and I said, will this video help me and my dog? Well, what's a dumb thing to say? But it never says no. It says, well, I'm sorry, this is Windows 11 updates. If you want stuff about your dog, it never says no. Put your own words in there. You can't go wrong. So if you want to find the top 3 tips, if you want to find whatever you want to know about that video, put it in your own words. I had a buddy, I saw a recall on a snowblower, Arian's Snowblowers, and I asked which models and years it applies to. I didn't have to watch the whole 12-minute video. And then later, if you want to watch the video, that's up to you. Okay, Perplexity. Let's move on to that one here. It's the search engine reinvented. And been around for over 2 years. I use it a lot. I use it a whole lot for everything. I mean, it has no limits for the basic prompts. Perplexity is like the librarian who gives you the exact book you wanted with no small talk. Accurate answers, researching facts. It'll also summarize your news articles. You can use the too long didn't read command with the prompt or the URL in there. And the major benefit to Perplexity, I find, is the follow-up questions. The follow-up questions for me is I find them very intuitive. They're things you wouldn't have thought of, and it makes you think in the right direction. And of course, this one also, you can also upload your PDF files. And I don't know who's behind Perplexity. I think I did before. I can't remember that part. I don't know. It's growing quickly, and these things are all changing very fast. It's a precision search engine here, Perplexity. So you may have noticed, I'm doing this two at once here. Here we go. Perplexity. Okay. You may have noticed all three of these support PDF uploads. I want you to use this to your advantage. Don't struggle and fit all these little cram stuff into your prompt box. It's easier than you think to pop your prompt into a Word document, another document, and then simply save that as a PDF. You get better prompts in there. I love to use GreenShot for graphics. You can easily put graphics in a PDF. If you're talking about a lawnmower and you want to point to the wheels, you can put a little arrow on your graphic and say, I want to know about the back wheels here, whatever you're talking about, and tell that to the AI. Whatever you're talking about, use your PDF and your graphics, pop it into a PDF, and send that to the AI for revision, evaluation, whatever you want from that, or that could be your prompt also. Now, using free AI, they have limits called tokens. When you save your PDF file, there's usually an area to use minimum size. So don't make it a big one. It'll keep your quotas down low. So as Alan mentioned here, no single AI is best. If you have these bookmarks copied for quick access, you can copy and paste your same prompt into multiple AIs and get the best answer you want for your question, for your resume. If the prompt is small enough, pop it in manually. But for a resume, I think I'd have to use a PDF for that prompt. There's too much to put in there. I get halfway through, I hit enter, and you've lost it. Start over again. So bookmark these items, and remember, I hope I've answered the question, probably not, I don't know. I told you all I know. AI is a tool, it's not a magic solution. Give it a clear prompt. Be as clear as you can with your own words, and your words do not have to be grammatically correct. You can put the most awkward grammar in there, and it'll figure it out, and good luck with that. And I'll pass things over to Alan now.
Question for you, Bob. Is it best to have a short prompt,
Thank
or do you give it as much text as you possibly can?
Oh, long prompt, for sure. Long. I my prompts are very long, yes.
So Marv is asking if a Copilot is another type of AI program or application.
Absolutely. I use Copilot a lot for simple and quick graphics. You can have a cartoon graphic or a realistic graphic. I spread things around because my limits get full. So I spread it around. But I have Copilot on my taskbar, and it's a major one. I also use Duck AI. You can upload files to Claude AI also in PDFs. They're all free.
Yeah, but Copilot is actually a general purpose AI bot, right? It's not just limited to graphics.
Oh, yes. General purpose, yes. You can ask it anything you would ask Perplexity, and works just fine.
Right. Okay, good. Well, I think that's it.
Can I just add one comment, Alan, if it's okay? I just wanted to mention that Chris updated the OPCUG member database, and he gave it to me to maintain. And I noticed there was quite a few cells with these very long, complicated formulas. I thought, oh, he's pretty good at Excel. And he just put it into ChatGPT and just said, well, I have this column, I got this column, I want this to do this and this to do that. And it gave him all the formulas, and he just plunked them into the Excel table. So that could be what they mean by coding, is it will actually give you coding.
Yeah, that's part of it, sure. AI, these bots, they know a lot of different programming languages, so you can ask it to write a program to, you know, to do X, Y, and Z in Python or JavaScript or whatever. It knows about Excel, so it will write macros for you in VBA, and it knows formulae for Excel. They're really good, and if you have a program that's not working, you can ask it to debug it. If the program gives you an error, you give it the error message, and it tells you what the correction is. And they're really, really fine tools to help with computer programming and scripting.
And with people who ask you for advice and so on, just say, go to perplexity.ai and follow their advice.
And sometimes that works quite well, Tom. You're right. Okay, moving along, we have a share here. Stu sent this information about Yucca, and I made up a couple of slides. I sent them to him and asked if he wanted to add anything, and he said no, he didn't, but he would make something up. So let's see what he's going to make up.
Well, first I'll speak the truth. I learned of Yucca because my wife was in one of those pop-up stores that last for a couple of years. It's the sort of place where when a discount store goes out of business, this place buys up all the stock and sells it 80% off of whatever it was at the other place. So it's really popular. And a woman was in there and showed my wife this app on her phone and said, have you tried this? So it's basically an app that you're shopping away for food and you scan the barcode on an item and it tells you if it's any good for you. As the slide says, it's from 1 to 100. So, you know, 100% or 0%. You can figure that out for yourself, I'm sure. It's pretty straightforward. It doesn't push anything. It's got a paid version, which is $15 a year subscription, but it really seems to be focused on the citizens of France because that's where it was originally from, features specific to that country that I'm not aware of, obviously. And it's nice. It tells you how much sugar or how many calories and, you know, basically is it good for you or is it not? And kind of a rough idea of why. And it shouldn't be considered an absolute rule book. It's just sort of a guide. You know, don't cut out chocolate completely because they have a special category for that. They're very liberal on chocolate. They seem to believe in it. But it's very popular with my wife. I haven't used it myself, so once again, I'm speaking of that which I know not. You know, I'm doing the best I can here, folks. But for the ladies, it also does cosmetics. So you can go scan your favorite facial cream or whatever cream and see whether it's good for you or not, or if you want to put it on your dog and see what happens first before you try it on yourself.
Good recommendations, Stu.
Well, I don't really use cosmetics. I find water does the trick for me for most things.
Just go on doggedly.
Yeah. But anyway, it's It's got a website that you can check out and get a little more detail on it. It seems to be a pretty good product for the most part for shoppers. Give it a look. I'm not recommending it. I'm just saying my wife likes it. Go with God, people.
It must be right. Okay.
All right. She's happy. I'm happy. What the hell can I say?
Thanks a lot, Stu.
You're welcome.
Okay, next up I have a YouTube video that might be of interest to some people. I keep running across these kind of historical videos on YouTube about various computing matters. This one's about Unix and how it was part of building the internet. It's really quite interesting, this D.G. Ware character. I don't really know who he is. He doesn't seem to have any kind of background information available on the web. You put his name in and you don't really turn anything up in terms of what he did in the past. But he obviously knows what he's talking about. He has a lot of really good information in here. And he has a very folksy type of narration style. Although it's a 20-minute video plus, it's actually quite interesting, and he puts it across in quite a good manner. So if you're at all interested in Unix and the internet and how everything developed, it's certainly worth a few minutes to take a look at that. Okay, next up we have a question that came in on reusing old computers. And this is someone who has an old computer that is running Windows 10 right now but won't be supported in the future. He's thinking he'd like to donate it to some agency that could reuse it. And he's asking, can we start a list of potential agencies? And I personally think this is a pretty short list. I know that CompuCore will take in hardware. However, it looks as though desktops are limited to post-2014, so if you have an earlier version than that, I don't think they're interested. They'll take laptops. They don't say if there's any limitations on laptops. And if you donate hardware to them, then they will apparently provide a tax receipt for the amount that this thing is worth. Chris mentioned that National Capital Freenet also will take electronics. In particular, if you look at the web page, they say that they will take old modems and routers, they will test them, and if they're suitable for reuse, then they'll reconfigure them and then give them out to members who need essentially free hardware. And he'll try to find another life for other types of electronics, but they don't really say how that works. So the question is, if anybody on the call tonight knows of any other outlets where you can donate electronics for reuse. I mean, we know there's lots of different places where you can send hardware to e-waste, but what about if you have, reasonably good hardware that has some use left in it, and where could people take that to have the thing reused rather than recycled as e-waste? Okay, so if you have any thoughts on that, put some answers in the chat and we'll revisit that at a later time. Next up, we have an interesting little item on backup systems. Again, kind of following up from all the backup stuff we've done recently. But Harvey, you've got some information on ESUS To-Do backup.
All righty. Thanks, Chris. Last week, Chris went over the back in time, the Linux version of his backups. And one of the items he focused on also was after you did the backup, you could view the content of the backup snapshot. So what I'm going to just point out tonight is the Windows equivalent if you're using the ESUS To-Do backup. So I do the weekly image backup, and it writes it out to an external drive. We can go to the next chart there. Now, on the external drive, I'm going to see a number of files. Of course, as you can tell, it's a weekly type backup that I do. And the file type is a .pbd. Now, say that quickly. You get tongue-tied. But that's a list of what backups were done. And my laptop has an NVMe SSD, which is simply a type of drive that is plugged into your motherboard. So it has 512, the maximum. But as you can see by the file I highlighted, it's about 120 gigabytes that is used. So ESUS only backs up on an image the area that has been used. So we can go to the next slide. Now, if you start up your Windows File Explorer and you click on a PBD file, you can view all the drive partitions that are within that backup. So as you can see, it's showing, this is my partition layout for my drive, and as you can see, there's the C partition that if I clicked on that, it'll open it up. Go ahead and to the next slide. And it's going to show me a list of all the folders and files on the C partition. And from there, if you had to recover a specific file, you can then search it out and look and find and do anything you need, and you could download it if you had to recover a certain file. So I found that's quite handy to be able to do. So similar to the Linux, we can do it in Windows too. That's about it. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Harry. That's a really useful technique, being able to browse the image that easily. It's really good. Okay, thank you. So moving along, Broadwatch.
Can I ask a couple of questions?
Sure.
I used that software yesterday for the first time. I tried to get it to put the file on my D drive. I thought I told it to do that. It hit it on my C, and it took me about 30 minutes to find it and another 3 hours to copy it over to my D drive, which I find really annoying. For one thing, I don't know why you would put a backup file on a C drive, which is the most likely drive to fail. So I can't see the logic in that. But that aside, the other thing is I noticed it has a feature where you can protect the file. And I thought I protected it, but I don't know if I unprotected it by moving it. So does anyone have any answers for me on that?
I've never used that feature. No. When you say protect it, do you mean encryption?
No, it doesn't encrypt. Okay. It protects it. I assume that meant that you can't overwrite it.
No, I've never used it.
It's just sitting on, it's sitting in my C drive, and it's sitting on my external drive right now. And I'm assuming that just meant that you can't possibly overwrite it.
If you use the File Explorer, right-click and try to find the properties on that particular file, does it show you whether it's protected?
No, it doesn't.
Okay.
I did look at that. I looked up the properties on both files because I just kept the two copies for this meeting to see what to see what you guys thought.
You may want to send a message in on the board, and we'll see if we can get an answer for you.
Okay.
Yeah, and going back to the question of the backup on the C drive, you certainly don't want to do that. You're absolutely right. When you're using ESUS to do backup, you do have to be a bit careful when you specify what the target drive is going to be. And it's not terribly intuitive, in my view, how you actually do that. But if you look at some tutorials or something, they'll show you exactly how to do it. You have to pick a local drive and then make sure that you've chosen your external USB, and then pick a folder and so on and so forth. So, you kind of have to select what you want rather than accept any kind of defaults. Okay, moving along to FraudWatch. I'm really amazed at the number of stories that we see on the news quite frequently about people who are being defrauded of thousands of dollars and in some cases hundreds of thousands of dollars. I mean, it's like these people don't read the newspapers or watch the television themselves or something until they get hit. And they certainly don't look at the OPCUG Fraud Watch page, or they'd know all about scams. And a couple of email messages came into suggestion box this week, and they look like scams. And Bob Harris is really big on feedback in these systems, so we're going to ask what you think. But here's the first one. The first one was from a member who a friend had received two messages. One was supposedly from Facebook, and the other one was from Meta Business. And she has a Facebook personal account, but the problem was supposedly related to adverts on a business page. These adverts had not met community standards, and the business wouldn't be able to place any more ads, and the account was going to be disabled, but she had 180 days to appeal and so on and so forth. So the individual suggested to her friend that she should try creating a new Gmail account and a new Facebook account, and she did that, and it worked for a week, and then the same messages showed up. And her husband had a Facebook account as well, but that one wasn't affected, so it didn't seem to be something related to the system, the in-house system, as it were. So the question is, what do you think? So if anybody has any thoughts at this point, you could put it in the chat or
We have one comment from Natalie about CBC Radio has a program, Learn to Be a Scammer. No, it doesn't say that, but in the chat here. What a radio show. Go ahead, Natalie.
Oh, no, it was just the first hour of the cross-country checkup show where they had a security expert and they were having people call in. And, yeah, some of those stories are heartbreaking. So, anyways, it was interesting to listen to the, different stuff that's going on.
I thought the really bad one that I heard was the guy that got caught by one of these romance scams, but he got caught twice. That was pretty bad. This one seems odd because it seems suspicious to me that the account, the Facebook account is personal, but these messages are talking about business activity. So I was asking, were they sure that these emails were actually coming from Facebook and not some kind of scam? And, was the personal account actually disabled? They said it was, but could they still use it or not? And the other thing to look at is, did it have any links, which are supposedly going to Facebook? And were those links actually pointing to Facebook if they were there? Now, personally, I don't use Facebook, and I'm just thinking that, this to me has all the hallmarks of one of these phishing scams where there's usually all kind of red flags. And you go to the FraudWatch page, and there are various examples of that. Now, the second one was another member who got an email from Margaret Beck, who had a Gmail address, but this individual doesn't know Margaret Beck, and the email contained a PDF file, or there was a link to a PDF attachment claiming to be a bill from PayPal. However, the member doesn't use PayPal all that often, so didn't think that there would be any bills floating around from PayPal. And said, should I just delete the email, and didn't want to open the PDF file in case it was loaded up with malware. So
I would say yes to exactly what you said. If you don't know who is sending you a message, get rid of it. There's all kinds of things that can be attached to attachments. And if you don't know who's sending it to you, why would you even bother with it? I would just erase it and get rid of it. My wife had a problem with Facebook years ago, where there seemed to be all kinds of stuff coming into it that we had no idea where it was coming from. So we shut down the account for 3 weeks. If you shut it down for, I think it's 30 days, they cancel it. We opened it up after 3 weeks, and we've never had a problem since. But basically, with all of these frauds, if you don't know who Margaret Beck is, why would you communicate? PayPal is a billing service. Somebody's going to want money. And for some reason, they're going to think that they're going to get you to pay money for something. That's probably what the end game is. So I just get rid of it. Move on with life.
Yeah, my thought was you can always just go on to PayPal directly and have a look at your account. If you owe them money, I'm sure they're going to tell you right there. But otherwise, I think I agree completely. That, to me, sounds like a total scam. The PDF file, if it is actually an attached PDF file, it's probably full of malware. And sometimes the PDF file isn't actually an attachment, it's just a link. And if you hover over the link, you'll find that it's going to somewhere really obscure and it's nothing to do with PayPal. So, just delete the message.
You can get viruses directly in the email by a PDF, especially if it's locked, or by any other kind of file, including images. So you're better off, unless you have an obscure email program like I do, you're better off not to open the message at all. Even opening it can be a problem. If you can look at the raw headers as to where it's coming from, and the sequence it went through to get to you, then that may help you decide if it's honest or not. But if it's obscure and strange, it's probably a scam of some sort or a virus.
Yeah, I think sometimes they're a lot more straightforward than that. I get a lot of these things, and sometimes they're from their invoices and their companies that I don't have any dealings with. But usually when you look at the email, there's lots of red flags. And if you look at the Fraud Watch page, there's all kinds of examples, poor English, URLs that are going to Bulgaria or somewhere, nothing to do with Rogers internet, that kind of stuff. However, it can happen, and the guy that runs the Have I Been Pwned website, he actually fell for a phishing email. He claims to have been jet-lagged and wasn't really paying much attention, but he clicked onto an email and ended up giving out all kinds of information about people who subscribe to his blog. Not the actual Have I Been Pwned website, but his personal blog was compromised to some extent, I guess. So it can happen to the best of us, and don't feel badly about it. But by the same token, you shouldn't be giving away tens of thousands of dollars to people that you don't know. Okay, the last question that came in is another one for comment. This member sends a Word document from his computer to somebody else, and when the file arrives on the second computer, now this is a Word file, and it contains endnotes, which are like references, but the endnotes don't show up. So he's asking, why is this, and is there a way to make sure that the endnotes stay where they are? Personally, I've used endnotes quite a bit as references in technical papers and so forth. I've never seen this problem, but clearly it exists. So the question is, has anybody seen it previously? Have you any experience like this? And how do you work around it? So while you're thinking about that...
Sorry, what are endnotes?
Endnotes are like footnotes, but instead of going at the bottom of the page, they go at the end of the document. So let's say you're writing a scientific paper, and I want to reference the article that Tom Trottier wrote a year ago. So I put that as an end note, and that becomes number one. And then I want to reference the one that Bob Harris did 6 months ago, and I put that in as an endnote, and it goes in as number two. And these are at the end of the document. So you see, you know, references, one, Tom's paper, two, Bob's paper.
Is it
what's happening here is that the main body text of the document is being viewed, but the endnotes at the end have disappeared.
Were they possibly in another font that isn't recognized by the receiver? Like, are they like footnotes where they change the font to make them smaller? I can't remember with endnotes.
Yeah, I think they do that, but I don't think that's a problem.
It would be some
because
sort
what
of
happens is when they send a document back, the footnotes are missing.
Is this Word, I gather?
This is Word, yes.
There's a lot of funny things in the very last character of a Word file that has stuff. And I wonder whether there's Chris Taylor. hi. And if you delete the last character in your Word document, you may be messing it up. And it's perhaps that also messes up the endnotes.
Okay, well, that's something to check. I think Kabinde is on the call tonight, so there's something to look at.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, so this has happened a number of times. I send a Word document, a reference with endnotes, to my editor, and when it comes back to me, the endnotes are missing. And I don't know why. Somebody suggested that maybe the person I sent to doesn't have the same version of Word. So that could be a problem. But I have also noticed that when I sent a document from my laptop to my desktop, and then I printed it from the desktop, and the endnotes were not there. They were not number. They were not. They were not there. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what to do because it's kind of unnerving when you have a paper, and this is a big document. It's going to be a big document, but I don't know how to deal with the problem of endnotes not showing.
Are they using Word at their end, and are you both using the same version of Word?
That is what I don't know, but I think that my laptop and my desktop use the same version of Word. I think we are using Word 2011.
I don't know if I'd call it a solution, but one alternative you could try is also to open it in LibreOffice and save it in their open document format and send them that and see if they can use, see if the endnotes stay in there.
Mm-hmm. What about saving a copy of the document to the cloud, to a cloud storage, and sending them the link to the file rather than relying on email to send it?
Yeah, that's a very good suggestion. The only thing is I'm not very tech savvy. So when you talk of you sent me a message today and talking about the, what was that, Libre what?
Libre Office.
Yeah, Libre Office.
It's a free office suite.
Okay, is it on Word, on MS Word or not?
It's on, it can work on Windows, Linux, and other and Mac for that matter. But okay. It's a different it's a different office, it's a different program, but it can read in Word documents and it can output Word documents. But it can also save in its own format, which is called Open Document Format.
Okay. So this is something that I have to download.
Yeah. Yes. It's a fairly, LibreOffice is fairly big, I'm afraid, but. It's an alternative to the Microsoft Office.
But it does handle Word endnotes. I checked that today. It works well with that.
But it won't help if the problem is at the editor's end. If the editor is doing something, then and it comes back without your endnotes, then there's nothing you're doing wrong.
Yeah.
Well, it's worse than that, though, because this is happening between the laptop and the desktop.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Oh, that's okay. Odd.
Well, that is weird.
I just pasted my email address into the chat, and if you wanted to send me one of your documents, I have the latest version of Word 365, and I could tell you if it comes up okay on my computer, if that's of use to you. But yeah, right. If you're getting the different effect, you know, between two computers that you own, where you open it up on the other computer and it loses the endnotes, and they're both using the same version of Word, that's really odd.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question.
So who's asking me to send them the, is it this Chris?
Yeah, it's me, yeah, Chris.
Okay, so. I will do that. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I can I can tell you if they, and I can edit the document slightly, they just change a word or two, and then save it and send it back to you, and you can see whether the endnotes are still there.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very odd.
Thank you very much.
I have a question. Normally, when we use a reference, there is a little 1, 2, 3 beside the word you use reference to. I don't know if EndNotes does the same thing, but do you see those little 1, 2, 3 beside the where you put the EndNotes?
Yeah, I see them. But when I send it for editing, then it comes back and the EndNotes are not there. And lately I noticed that when I sent a document from my laptop to my desktop and then printed it from my desktop, the EndNotes were not there. And that is something I hadn't seen before.
But even the numbers inside the document disappear also?
They don't appear inside the document either.
Okay, so the EndNotes disappear and also the number inside the document disappear
mm-hmm.
also.
Mm-hmm.
Are they renumbered?
No.
Do you get a blank page?
No, I don't get a blank page. But I noticed that when I have chapters, and lately I put the chapters together. This is another thing. I put the chapters together. And then at one point I noticed that it got to a point where the EndNotes began from number 19, which was about page 30. It repeated the same number until page 94.
Do you have EndNotes? Are the EndNotes for the whole document or are they for each chapter?
Well, they're for each chapter, but when I put the document together, then I'm having a problem with that.
Do you put them in one file when you put them together?
Yes.
I believe, at least from my memory from years ago, you can create a document that references each chapter and keeps it and keeps each chapter separate as a separate file. But then you have an overall document that,
mm-hmm.
that references each chapter and brings it in.
Mm-hmm.
I found Word awkward for really big documents like books and so on.
Yes.
To do things. I don't have a solution for you, but someone who creates big Word documents or books might have. But I guess there's no one on the on the chat right now that does that.
Actually, Jocelyn had a very interesting idea there. He put into the chat to disable EndNotes in Word and convert the citations to plain text. You can do that. So that might be the thing that you could do when you send it to the editor. Now, they're not going to be able to, you know, treat it as an EndNote anymore, but it will be there as plain text as opposed to an actual EndNote. But if they don't need to do any editing on the document, then that might be a workaround that could work for you.
But would they still be in the middle of the document, like where the rest?
Yeah, I think it will end up that it's just not a live EndNote anymore. So, but it'll be there as plain text.
The numbers would still be in the middle of the document.
I presume it will. Yeah.
What is the EndNote a special control character, or what does it look like?
Well, that's the little ones. Like in Wikipedia, where you have the references to things that are further down, So you have like one in square brackets, two and three and so on in square brackets. And at the end, you have a reference, which one is to this document, two is this document, these pages and so on.
And they are linked. So if you click on that, like if you have a sentence and you put an endnote at the end of it, you have a link there which will actually take you to the endnote itself. Now, if Jocelyn says you disable the endnotes by converting the plain text, you lose that hyperlink capability, but presumably the number will still stay there and the endnote will stay there, but it'll just be plain text. They're no longer linked together.
If you have chapters as separate files, and when you bring them together, you have a master document that refers to those separate files, then I think you might be able to copy the master document and change the endnotes in the master document without affecting the individual chapters. But you'd have to play around with it and fiddle with it. But that's one possibility that you might be able to do to create the master document, and then do a select all, copy it into a new document that has everything flat, like all the chapters are included, into a new document name, and at that point, change all the endnotes to click show notes, and then choose all endnotes in the notes pane, and change that to convert citations and bibliography to plain text, and then you can send that one single file to the to your editor.
Okay, I'll try that. And I think when I'm putting it into a master document, what I need to do is after one chapter, I should create a blank page to separate chapter one from chapter two. Okay. I hope that, I don't know if that will help, but that's what I'm thinking, so that each chapter keeps its end notes.
Again, I blanked out there for a moment.
So what I'm saying is when I'm putting the chapters together into a master document, I should do chapter one and then leave a blank page there. And then chapter two, at the end of the chapter, I leave a blank page so that the endnotes don't get mixed up.
That might help, or you could do insert a page mark at the end of each chapter.
Right.
In fact, that might be an idea to have that anyway.
Another possibility, not likely to work, but it's nothing to try it other than a bit of time, would be trying to do a repair on your Office program. So to do that, if you go to Settings, Apps, and then you find your version of Microsoft Office listed there, you click it, and then you have an option to modify. And then if you go in there, there'll be a quick repair or an online repair. And if it happens to be that it's something is messed up within the program itself, that might fix the problem. It's certainly something that it's not going to hurt. And who knows, it might fix something.
Okay.
Quick question.
It's possible that I may have found an answer to also, because you can view different things. And here I found something that says, to view endnotes in Word, go to the Reference tab, click Show Notes, and then choose All Endnotes in the Note pane. I posted that in the on the chat. So it might be just that the viewing of the notes, endnotes, are not enabled.
Okay.
So if you go to the Reference tab, click Show Notes,
okay,
and then choose All Endnotes in the notepad thing.
Okay. All right. I'll try that.
And there are quite a few suggestions in the chat for this issue, and also a whole bunch of stuff about scans and so forth. So the chat will be posted to the website later on. You can download it there and review everything later on.
There's another possibility as well. It's possible that the COM add-in in Word is disabled during the transfer. I just got this answer from Perplexity, and I'm posting it right now.
From Serge?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay, thank you very much.
Lots of things you can try.
Okay, I will. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
Okay, so I think we had our discussion here, so let's move on to the wrap-up. Some upcoming presentations. If you want to go to Chris's AI tools, you're too late because it's already fully subscribed, and I guess there's several people already on the waiting list. They've even closed the waiting list.
If you want to come to that, just show up. don't worry about it being full. They fully expect people to just drop in.
So that's Carlingwood on Monday, April the 7th. And then Windows Performance Tune-Up, Manatic, on April the 10th. We're going to have a hybrid meeting in April the 23rd. It's going to be at Emerald Plaza, which is in kind of in the west end of downtown anyway. And because this date's close to Easter, I thought it would be interesting if we look at software Easter eggs. So the question is, which Easter eggs do you know about? And preferably ones that we can use today. I mean, I know there's lots of historical ones, and I think quite a few of those have been taken away now from security concerns and higher security packages and so forth. So if you know of any Easter eggs, please let us know, and we'll include them in that hybrid meeting.
There's Easter eggs on probably about 50% of all the DVDs and Blu-ray discs that have been produced.
There we go. Send us some ideas.
Well, I know there's one on Terminator 2.
But are they chocolate?
Yeah, I don't remember exactly what the combination was, but you used something and you got to see extra scenes that weren't included.
Cool.
Okay, next week is our regular monthly meeting for April, and the topic is CERA, the Canadian Internet Registration Authority, and all the various things that they do and packages that might be of use to us as users, I guess. So that's next week, April the 9th, which means that there's no Q&A next week. So we have 2 weeks now to think about your questions and things that you would like to share. So our next Q&A will be in 2 weeks on April the 16th. So thanks to everyone for your patience in me firing up this meeting, for asking questions and lots of discussion, especially for the presentations we had, the shares from Stu and Bob and Harvey. We had a pretty good mix of stuff tonight, lots of discussion, which was really good. So thanks very much for everybody for attending, and we'll see you next week at the monthly meeting.